tonight on Arena. 40 years on, we look at the legendary Talking Heads concert film Stock Making Sense, and we preview The Changeling on Apple TV, starring Lakeith Stanfield. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. It's hard at this stage in time, I think, to overstate just how exciting and new everything was about Stop Making Sense, the film Jonathan Demme made about or of the Talking Heads tour in LA in December in 1983. They were already one of the coolest bands around, combining eccentric art house sensibilities with commercial success. Then came David Byrne's iconic oversized suit, his solo performance of Psycho Killer on a bare, unfinished set before the rest of the band, Tina Weymouth and Chris France and Jerry Harrison, and their instruments joined him on stage. Just 5 years after Martin Scorsese's The Last Waltz documented the final concert by the band and a stellar cast of their best friends, Stop Making Sense deconstructed the whole idea of the gig. This month, to mark its 40th anniversary, Stop Making Sense is re-released in cinemas in a brand new 4K restoration. Paul McLoon is with me in studio. To travel down memory lane, I think, is what you're going to do in some ways, Paul. Obviously, for the most part, it was a big sensation at film festivals around the world and in cinemas in 1984 and 85. When and where did you see it?
The perfect time and the perfect place. I was literally a fresher. I just started. I think I was at Queen's University in Belfast in the winter of 1985. And I think I'd been there a wet week, or probably a very wet week. And it was on at the QFT, Queen's Film Theatre. Right. There was a little season of movies on, cool movies. And that was one of them. So I hadn't seen it up to that point. So I was a fan of the band. And
I was going to say, I'm guessing you were a big fan. Did you have an oversized suit?
Not yet.
But it was on the way. It was ordered.
I may well have invested subsequently. Yeah, I was a fan of the band, but I hadn't been thrilled by the album Speaking in Tongues, which represented a very deliberately and very successfully move into a much more mainstream commercial sort of musical area for the band. Because up until that point, they'd been completing this trilogy of albums with Brian Eno, which were very exploratory and experimental and unorthodox. Mm. Brilliant albums, particularly Remain in Light with the incredible Once in a Lifetime single, of course, which I'm sure is a lot of people's favourite Talking Heads track. But Speaking in Tongues was a very different record to those previous records. It was very kind of glossy and funky, and it just left me a little cold. It felt a little kind of sanitized and a little sort of pedestrian, really, by their standards, for me.
Yeah.
But then Stop Making Sense came along and kind of weirdly addressed all the problems I had with that record in the live context. It was amazing how they retooled those songs and they became these amazing, funky, live, very muscular kind of workouts that they just weren't for me on the original studio record.
All right. And what's interesting then, what Jonathan Demme did is that basically he put a little bit more than he put the camera on the gig and he let it play out. But essentially he brought us into the gig in a way that hadn't been done before. How did he achieve that?
I think he was quite clever. I think he was kind of a master. Well, obviously a very talented director, as we know, and he subsequently went on to be hugely successful, and rightly so. But I think he understood that for this to work, maybe with someone that's already as theatrical as that, and when you're dealing with an artist like Talking Heads, and probably it's probably fair to say most of this was probably coming from David Byrne, and when you're dealing with a guy like that, you kind of got to just let you know, you can't clash with that, you can't throw in too many of your own ideas and potentially create sort of creative conflict in there. So he very wisely sort of stood back, kept it very simple, didn't go for very flashy, super fast edits, stayed with the one shot for longer than you probably would normally see in a concert movie, didn't try to color it in. The theatrical presentation was quite stark, almost Beckettian at the beginning, where David Byrne comes on his own. It's just this very stark set, and it sort of builds up from there, but it maintains this kind of black, almost black and white, monochrome. There's no big flashy coloured lights. There's no big special effects. And Demme was smart enough to realise, well, don't put that in. It's not part of the original kind of idea. Film what's there, but do it in, obviously, a brilliant, directorly, subtly great kind of way, which he did. And for that reason, I think, not you know, not to take anything away from the music, but I think it's helped the whole idea that this thing hasn't dated at all. You put it on now and it still looks cutting edge. It still looks like like anything else.
As we listen to Psycho Killer, we have to think David Byrne on the stage, kind of half-finished set feel.
Yeah, it's very...
By himself.
Yeah.
Big suit. White box type of thing
I don't think he's got the suit on. I think the suit appears.
All right,
which is kind of brilliant because he sort of walks out and he's got the suit.
So you see him almost dressing into character then. Well, let's have a listen to the beginning of Psycho Killer and how it kind of winds its way into that action.
Hi, I got a tape I want to play. Can't relax, can't sleep, run, run, run away. Oh, oh, psycho killer, guess to say.
And it's even, that's Psycho Killer from The Live, the soundtrack to Stop Making Sense, the film which turns 40 this year. Ooh. Paul McLoone with me in the studio. But even as you hear him doing the, you know, the bop-bop-bop-bop bit there, David Byrne of Talking Heads, he kind of he's refinding that song in some ways, isn't he?
Yeah, and it's actually striking the way he makes that work with so little going on. That's just an acoustic guitar. Well, probably an acoustic guitar through the desk or whatever, but an acoustic guitar and a little drum machine.
Yeah, because he says at the top, I have a bit of tape.
A tape I want to play you.
Yeah.
Don't go away, I won't hurt you. and he just does that minimal, it's so minimalist. But for me now, that version is actually superior to the original studio version. That's the one I would go to. Also, great rhythm guitar player.
Amazing.
I spent years copying that chicka-chicka-chicka-ching thing. Without much success, but I did try. But yeah, it just works brilliantly. And he's just got great... I think at this point in his career and with the band and everything else, his instincts are spot on.
Yeah.
He's just very, very smart.
And you were saying about that Demi was... Obviously, he was dealing with this sort of art school sensibility that Byrne in particular had, but Talking Heads in general had. But Byrne was very much at the forefront of that. And I think it was Byrne's decision. I mean, the camera was on the stage all the time, usually in a concert video, a video of a concert like that, you'd see cutaways to the audience at certain times. But Byrne was quite definite as to why that shouldn't happen.
Yeah, I kind of get it. It keeps your attention focused where it should be in a way. So, you know, if you're going to do the job of a concert movie, which presumably is to replicate the experience of the concert, cutting away to the audience can actually be a bit distracting.
Yeah.
And Demi eschews that kind of cliched reaction shots all the time until I think towards the end where he actually does, he gives the audience their little moment in the spotlight, if you like. But I think it's a sound decision. I think it also helps, the intensity of the film, because it is a bit of a ride, this film. You kind of have to just watch it all the way through and kind of watch it develop and go, you know, be along with the expansion of the set and the band and the musicians. By the end of the film, there's like 9 or 10 of them up there on stage, and it just all works so organically almost.
And the other thing, I think the other aspect of not filming the audience was Byrne maintained that if you put the camera in the audience, they'll stop dancing. They'll become self-conscious and, you know, and then the kind of the energy goes out of it.
They did do a take. I think they did a night where it just didn't work.
And they stuck and
I think the band got a bit sort of self-conscious. It didn't play terribly well. So again, it just shows you these were kind of decisions that might be against the norm and flying in the face of what with all due respect to Scorsese with The Last Waltz, of course, a classic concert movie. But this is nothing like that. This is kind of breaking all the rules in a sense.
And the moment when the suit does arrive on then, and Byrne is kind of swallowed up in it, David Byrne is kind of eaten by it in some ways, isn't he?
Very deliberately. I think he got the idea, I think from travels in Japan and designers or whatever that he was looking at. But I think the idea, the very typical David Byrne idea was, actually, just to echo what we were saying about the audience a second ago, he wanted someone that would make his body look big and his head look small, Not just for a laugh, although it is kind of semi-comical effect, but it's just so strange as well and odd. But I think the idea was, it was, according to him anyway, it's because he wanted to reflect the fact that music and rhythm hits the body first and the head last. And, you know, he wanted to amplify his body and minimize his head in the presentation of it, which is kind of cerebral and maybe slightly kind of pretentious, but it just makes for an incredible visual.
And sometimes comparisons are drawn with Spike Lee when he filmed Birds' American Utopia Tour in 2020. That came to the Three Arena in 2018.
I was lucky enough to be there, and it is really one of the most extraordinary live shows I've ever seen. Again, completely breaking every rule. A few similarities with Stop Making Sense and how it was presented. Quite brightly lit. Not an awful lot of props or anything going on the stage. The gimmick, or not the gimmick, but the kind of the USP with the American Utopia show was very much the band. They were all moving all the time. Whereas Stop Making Sense is much more traditional in the way the band is eventually all set up. They're not moving around the stage. Probably the technology didn't really exist to do that very well back then. But the American Utopia show, again, just breaks every rule that you can think of in terms of how you present an artist and his band on stage, and works brilliantly, as anybody who was there will know. And if you weren't there and you haven't seen the Spike Lee movie yet, check it out. It's just incredible. It would have been amazing to see what Jonathan Demme did with that show.
Yeah, and time, isn't it? In Once in a Lifetime, we hear the lyrics says, "Time isn't holding us. Time isn't after us. Time isn't holding up." Does this film hold up across its four decades?
I think it absolutely does, and then some. And I think it's really because he eschewed a lot of those cliches of that type of filmmaking at the time as well. No split screens, no fancy editing, no kind of weird special effects or pretentious diversions, just the show as it happened, but directed brilliantly, obviously, from a cinematic point of view. And I think also, crucially, the music stands up too. Mm. It's not weighed down by a lot of those 80s production trappings that have kind of blighted a lot of music from that time, that particularly the first half of the 1980s, when producers and bands had all these new toys and they were just messing with them all the time, and now it sounds really dated. Whereas it's very clean. It's a digital recording. It's one of the early digitally recorded albums, I think. There's a wee bit of fixing and mixing going on, as there always is with live albums, but it just works, and the energy is there, and the audience, even though they're not in the movie a lot, you can feel the energy of the audience on the album. And I think for all those reasons, the music stands up and the visuals absolutely stand up. I can't wait to see it in the restoration. It's going to be incredible.
Yeah, 4K restoration. You'll be along to the IMAX somewhere to see it. That's Stop Making Sense.
Even bigger suit there.
Yeah, bigger suit. Exactly. It'll look a 4D type of thing. Stop Making Sense, released on 22nd of September in IMAX cinemas. And then it will be on general release from the following week, the 29th of September. He played the zombified brother in Get Out and the Black Judas in The Black Messiah. Now, Academy Award nominee Lakeith Stanfield takes the lead in the new Apple TV series called The Changeling. It's based on a novel by Victor Lavelle, and it tells the harrowing story of a young New York family slowly torn apart by a supernatural curse. This so-called fairy tale for grown-ups is directed by acclaimed filmmaker and music video director Melina Matsoukas, known for her Queen and Slim videos, as well as Beyoncé's Lemonade. Chris Wasser has been watching The Changeling for us. He's with me in studio this evening. I suppose Irish people, you know, the whole idea of The Changeling is kind of, most people will have heard of it in terms of, in this country, it's the fairies come and swap your child, basically. Take the child that was born to you and swap another child in its place. What's happening in this version of The Changeling? Is it a tale of a swap child or something like that?
It is, and it feels a little wrong to say that, but I mean, you know, you're giving it away in your title, and also on the poster you've got Lakeith Stanfield, you know, doing his best to protect this baby. So you know at some stage that A, fairy tales are going to be involved, and that B, Lakeith Stanfield is going to realise that his baby isn't his baby. It's actually the mother that realises that first, but we have to do an awful lot of backstories. There's an awful lot happening in this series, Sean, but I'll try and keep things tight and focused. We're with Apollo Kagwa.
He is...
Keith Stanfield character. And the year is 2010, and we see him immediately fall when he meets this librarian Emma. He immediately falls for this librarian. He works in antique books. He's in the library. He notices her. He asks her out. She's played by the brilliant Clark Bacow. She says no 6 times. The first problem with this series is that, you know, we're supposed to find this whole setup, this whole chase endearing, but he kind of basically bothers her into saying yes. They have actually, you know, a lovely first date.
Well, let's listen to them on their first date. You'll get a sense of the kind of dynamic between them when she eventually agrees to go out with him. As you said, Clark Bacow playing the character of Emma, and here Apollo played by Lakeith Stanfield on their first date.
Boone's Mill?
Yeah, you haven't heard of it.
Population 285. It's just where my parents landed, I guess.
Well, I bet your parents had a lot of cool stories about Boone's fucking mill.
I've never spoken to them.
Huh?
I mean, I'm sure I have actually spoken to them. I just don't remember the conversation because they died when I was 5.
Oh,
no, yeah, it's not a thing.
So, how'd they die?
Unimportant.
Well, what happened?
To them?
To you.
My sister Kim adopted me. She's 13 years older.
Shit.
And Ms. Rook, the local librarian, she would look after me when Kim couldn't. And she would let me and my best friend Michelle watch all the movies. One day, I was 12, and I picked up this movie at random. Random, it was the only movie in the entire library that had black people on the cover. Quilombo. It's about the uprisings in Brazil, and it's just like a ton of Portuguese people just getting like brutally killed by slaves.
There you go. That's a first date to remember. Clark Bacow as Emma and Keith Stanfield as Apollo in a scene from the Changeling News TV series on Apple TV. Chris Wasser watching it for us. They died when, what about your parents? They died when I was 5. What happened?
Unimportant.
Oh, it's unimportant.
Yeah.
You know, immediately it is very important. You know, it's hardly something you can bat off into play.
Yeah. But also, that's not the strangest thing that they talk about on this date. The date goes so well, and Apollo is delighted with himself. And he comes on very strong, and he says to her that, you know, the one thing that he wants to do with his life is be a father, which you would think, okay, this guy's a bit intense. But she says that, you know, they might not be able to have a future because she's moving to Brazil. That's why she said no to him 6 times before. But he thinks, you know, I'll wait for you. Now, the show doesn't really let us know how long he's waiting, but some amount of time passes. You know, Emma's away in Brazil. While she's in Brazil and she comes back, she is at a forbidden lagoon and she sees this witchly figure by a lake.
And is this the first hint we get of a kind of a supernatural aspect to the story?
Yeah, we know that Apollo is haunted by dreams of his father having run away when he was just 4. He was raised by his
mother. So we have parental issues on Apollo's side as well.
On Apollo's side, yeah. I mean, his mom and dad, we also see their story play out in the 60s and also in the 70s. And they met in a very similar way in that, you know, Apollo's dad actually bothered Apollo's mom into, you know, eventually going out with them. And they actually went to see Rocky on their first date in the 1970s then. That's where, you know, the name Apollo came from, because they thought Rocky would be a silly name, but not Apollo. He kind of always has this thing that he says to his kid, you know, you are the god Apollo. And then even as a grown up, Apollo's always saying that, I am the god. But he walked out when he was 4 and he has these nightmares about him. So that maybe is the first supernatural tease. The major one is in Brazil, at that forbidden lagoon, this witchly figure tells Emma, she seems to know an awful lot about Emma, you know, that she will be granted 3 wishes while she's wearing this string, this red string bracelet. If she removes the red string bracelet, terrible things will happen to her, that those wishes will just evaporate and, you know, something might happen to her life or someone else's.
And what about the plausibility of those aspects of the plot? I mean, do you find yourself kind of raising your eyebrow that or not? Or do you buy it?
You find yourself raising your eyebrow as Apollo does, you know, when the two of them reconvene and they start to live, you know, what they think is their happily ever after, getting married and having children. They, you know, he just cuts the bracelet off of her arm and says, with me, all of your wishes will come true. And we think, well, that, yeah, of course, it has to be bull. That has to be just be, you know, That obviously means nothing. But the show is very good at creating that ominous, you know, dread-inducing tension where you know...
With music or with dialogue
with music,
and acting?
With some snippets thrown in every now and then to kind of make it look almost like a dream. You know, the characters are always haunted. For instance, when the characters are having conversations about their past lives or about, you know, or stuff that happens to them when they're kids, we see flashes up on the screen. So we know that there was a house fire involved at some stage. We know that, you know, Brian, or that the dad's name is Brian. We know that Apollo is haunted by these disturbing visions of his father that may be real, they might not be real. So it's very good at letting us know that although very human drama is playing out in front of us, there's an awful lot of horror coming.
All right. I'll play a second clip now, which is a little bit further on, because at this stage they are married, then they have a young baby, but there's a lot of tension coming up between them. I don't know if she's lost the bracelet at this stage or not. She probably has.
Oh, she has, yeah.
She has lost the bracelet. Okay. Emma has problems bonding with the baby. And Lakeith as Apollo, once again, Lakeith Stanfield as Apollo and Clark Bacco as Emma from The Changeling.
So the appraisal guy was
talking... I want to get the baby baptized.
Brian? You talking about you, Brian?
Ooh, that's a big boy.
Your mother's been asking ever since he was born. I thought we should finally do it.
Good job. His appetite is getting amazing. He's eating more than me now.
I made an appointment at the church around the corner, Holyrood. Father Hagen seems nice.
When?
Today, in an hour.
Wow. Okay, I'm glad you decided to include me in that.
You don't have to be there. I can take him on my own.
What are you talking about? You're not going anywhere with my son without me. Emma, why is it falling in the garbage?
I got another text last night.
Okay.
A photo of you and the baby in the zip car. He was in the car seat. The photo was taken through the window. Like someone crept right up next to the baby.
Brian! His name's Brian. Who's loud?
There you go, Lakeith Stanfield as Apollo, Clark Bacco as Emma in a scene from The Changeling, and Baby Brian in the background there. Chris Wasser has been watching the series first. I have to say, Chris, listening to that, because I was worried that when you were talking about tension being built, that it would be these, you know, ominous music underneath, grumbling, growling film score, but the performances there really carry the tension of that scene.
They do, and there is an awful lot, and there is a lot of the, you know, music bubbling underneath and horror tension and all that. But those scenes, the human story, that works very well. I loved it when it was just that, because Victor Lavelle, who is the author whose book is the source material here and was very heavily involved in this adaptation, he wrote this book and came up with an awful lot of ideas when he became a father for the first time. And although it's not autobiographical in any stretch, it does kind of, you know, show us that, you know, although two people are very excited about being parents, the harsh reality is that you're going to be tired, that, you know, there will be resentment, that there will be some tension, that there will be arguments.
But you probably should discuss baptism and things like that more than an hour before the possibility of the event happening.
This is true, yeah, because Emma, she, you know, you heard there that she's thrown her phone in the bin. She becomes, she starts receiving text messages from an anonymous number showing her Brian, or showing her Apollo and Brian. And she's like, who are these text messages from? But the messages keep disappearing. So it's this idea that Emma has fallen into exhaustion, into depression after giving birth, and that Apollo doesn't believe any of the things that she's saying.
Victor Lavelle, as you say, wrote the original novel. Not always a good idea for the writer of the book to be present or to be part of the adaptation, because where flashbacks and scenes from the past and, you know, kind of explainers as to people's backgrounds, they'll fit into a novel an awful lot easier than they will into a television series where they might become confusing. Is his presence there a problem?
I think so. He also narrates it, which is not a good idea.
He narrates it.
He might be a good writer, but he's certainly not a good narrator. I think if you're going to narrate a horror series, you got to go for the Vincent Price or nothing at all, because there's no personality, there's no oomph in that in those lines. All of the stuff that we've heard there, exceptional. The stuff from Lakeith Stanfield and Clark Bacco, Lakeith Stanfield is a superstar. He makes it funny when it's barely witty. He makes it scary when it's kind of silly. They really do stand out. In terms of the storytelling and the horror, it is all over the place. It is just, sometimes it had me watching the screen going, what is going on? And the content is easy to keep up with, but the order in which everything is placed, it's so jumbled.
Yeah, so then, again, I'm wondering, who does that come down to? Does it come down to Victor Lavelle, or does it come down to the director, Marlene Matsuka? Yeah, brilliant for her award-winning video, music videos. That's a different thing from a whatever. How many part series is it going to be?
So, this might be just a one part, but there are signs that, you know, let's just say it doesn't tidy things up, that there could be an opening there for a second one. Melina Matsoukas is a wonderful director. I loved Queen and Slim with Jodie Turner-Smith and Daniel Kaluuya. The series is beautiful to look at, and just, the performances, the look of it, everything like that. The writing from Kelly Marcel, whose previous screenwriting credits include the Venom films and 50 Shades of Grey, not great. Some of the things that the characters say to each other at times, they're quite hard to believe. It's that storytelling. It reminded me an awful lot, and I think we spoke about it on the show before, 1899 on Netflix, which a lot of people liked, but were also frustrated with, because it's this puzzle box storytelling that's kind of taken over a lot of streaming shows, where something that could have made for a decent 2-hour film stretched over 8 to 10 hours, and you need to have an awful lot of patience to kind of check in on one character 1 minute. You know, we'll go back to that. We'll start a new story now. There's too many threads, too many balls in the air.
You wanted less. But if you bear with the first 3 episodes, which are available to stream right now on Apple TV Plus, you know, if you'd watch those in one lump, does the confusion start to calm down? Is the story starting to become clearer?
It should be starting to become clearer, but it gets even more confusing. And also, oddly, Sean, Samuel T. Herring from Future Islands all of a sudden pops up. Samuel T. Herring, who has very little acting experience, pops in as this strange man who might be able to help Apollo kind of figure everything out. No, it gets more jumbled. It gets more confusing. It asks a lot of us. But the Keith Stanfield's performance, I will say, it is brilliant. I do. If he's in something, I'm always excited about it. But I just wish it was neater.
Will you come back to watch the Keith Stanfield alone?
Once I've forgotten how jumbled and how frustrating the whole thing is, I'll probably give it another try, and I'll probably be upset again about it.
That's good. Chris Wasser speaking to us about The Changeling. First 3 episodes, as I said, now available to stream on Apple TV Plus. New episodes arriving weekly through until October 13th. Time now for album reviews. First up will be Roisin Murphy with her latest release, Hit Parade. The Irish singer has been in the headlines for other reasons, which we will get to, but her 6th album is an eclectic chill-out mix suited to her adopted home of Ibiza. Next up, American singer-songwriter and actress Olivia Rodrigo releases her 2nd album, Guts. She first came to prominence on various Disney TV shows. Signed to Geffen Records in 2020, her debut single, Driver's License, became one of the best-selling songs of that year. Sour, her debut album, was met with critical and commercial success, winning 3 Grammy Awards. And finally, Dream Big, 2nd studio album from Irish band Soda Blonde, released their debut album Small Talk in 2021, nominated for RTE's Choice Music Prize for Album of the Year. Let's start with Roisin Murphy and the first single from the album, Hit Parade. It's called Coo Cool.
I lost it.
Oh, that'll bring you back for sure. Coo Cool from Roisin Murphy from her latest album, Hit Parade. Alan Corr and Dean Regan, as I say, are my reviewers on this Friday evening. The elephant in the room has to be dealt with, first of all, the message that Roisin Murphy posted on a private Facebook account about the use of puberty blockers, where she said, and I'm quoting from her here, "Little mixed up kids are vulnerable and need to be protected," close end quote. The post was then screenshotted, widely shared, and Roisin Murphy quickly apologised. Again, I'm quoting here, for being the reason for this eruption of damaging and potentially dangerous social media fire and brimstone. End quote. So, Hit Parade, Alan, is it being viewed absolutely and totally through that prism? Can we get away from that prism?
I don't think so, no. I mean, this is genuinely one of the most anticipated records of the year, Sean, but now it comes straight with this controversy that will leave a sour aftertaste for a lot of people, I think. I mean, it's anticipated very much so, but it's hard to kind of separate the controversy from the music. But that's what we're here to do tonight, I think. The damage, she's apologised to me, to my mind anyway, fulsomely, but the damage has already been done. Two of her gigs to promote the album have been cancelled. Her new label, Ninja Tune, are now not promoting the album, which is very, very significant. I contacted them several times looking for confirmation on this and whether they had a press release, and answer came there, none. So her words were weaponized by both sides of the debate, which often happens here. Her very huge, you know, LGBTQ fan base were very distressed. There was a particularly anguished review in The Guardian yesterday, but the other side of the debate weaponized it for their own ends as well. So I think that it's very important to concentrate on the music.
Yeah, and let's do that. The content of the music, she has such a wonderful fan base. I mean, in fact, used that as a great line against, was it a Guardian interview where she said something about, the interviewer said, even your fan base are perfect.
Yeah, she was describing an argument she had with her daughter. She lives with her partner and her two kids in Ibiza, and her daughter had a confrontation with her, a teenage confrontation, and the daughter said, "How would you know, Mom? Your life is perfect. Even your fan base is perfect."
Your teenage daughter.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, of course,
so,
your teenage daughter's
going to
feed that.
And Roisin kind of smiled, and as she related it to, I think it was Alexis Petridis in the Guardian, and said, "You know, my fan base kind of is perfect." And you know, getting back to the introduction, that is a tricky place now in which that she finds herself, because that fan base has felt so alienated by some of her comments. But I fundamentally and totally agree with Alan that the place, tonight is the place to review the music. And actually, this album has been 6 years in the making. It's the product of a collaboration with a German producer who has poured work into this record. There's an amazing sort of assembly of layers on this album. Many different types of vocal register, different types of vocals, voice notes that are embedded into the tracks, a kaleidoscopic sense. And sometimes, to be honest, I was saying to Alan outside, I got a little bit of almost like vertigo listening to this, because there's no centre to many of the tracks. And she's throwing more colour and dynamism at you than you might get if you were watching one of those kind of Disney cartoons for kids.
I must say, I've said it on more than one occasion in and around a Roisin Murphy album, she can do no wrong musically, it seems to me. She has a phenomenal breadth of talent, phenomenal breadth of influences, and they all come to bear on everything she sings and does without kind of beating you over the head.
Well, absolutely. She's a woman of many voices and faces. As you know, she's always embraced art, design and fashion and the theatrics of performance. This is a real magpie approach of an album. It's got hip-hop, weird pop, house music, dubstep. It's all over the place. In fact, it sounds like it's running interference on itself, like it's trying to sabotage itself in some ways.
It even has a little bit of Tommy Tiernan, which we listen to.
Which is such a surprise when it crops up. You're like, what?
Yep. This is in a track called The House. People may remember the interview she did on the Tommy Tiernan show a while back. So she obviously is using a little bit of that at the top of this particular track. And there's a little bit in rude language just at the end of the interview section, as you will hear.
So what I know of you is that you're based in England.
Yes.
And you're
a woman.
So I'm going to go over it over and over.
Yeah, I want to listen to more of it than that, but we need to get to the other two albums as well. It's a wonderful line that she used, you know, because obviously the thing, Tommy doesn't necessarily know the people who are in front of her. He has a rough idea who they are. And when he gives her that open, "You are
a woman,"
she answers, which is quite
Tommy
brilliant.
Never has any idea who's in front of him, by the way, Sean.
He may know roughly who the person is. He knows some of the people who come. No, I know he doesn't know who they're going to be, but he may know them when he may recognise them. That's what I mean. And then it goes off into that. Yes, big long. Yeah, let's not go down that rabbit hole. a big long after the interview, you get straight into the music, and again, the music is just so good.
Yeah, I have to say though, like the introduction of soul into her repertoire. I mean, yes, of course, she's dabbled in it before, but bringing it in a stronger way. There were times when I found that a little tricky, because some of what she's done before, she's been such a fully fledged disco diva and so directional and so beloved of sort of the catwalk models, and in a way she's always had this sort of edgy, directional, singular sort of vibe, and it's sort of, for me, sometimes felt a little confusing to see someone like Roisin Murphy suddenly take on this kind of soul groove with the sort of warm, chocolatey, welcoming kind of vibe, because the two sort of images felt very different from each other. And actually, you can even feel it on the video for Fader, which was created in her native Arklow, where she has like a beautiful parade of Irish people and she's being really warm and huggy. And it's just not how I've ever thought of her in my imagination. Yeah. So to some extent, it felt a bit like, I don't know, cheese and chocolate or something, where you're going, whoa, this is, or when David Gray did White Ladder and you had the beats coming in, you were like, okay, can I see this version of Roisin? So it took a little time to adjust.
Well, if you haven't tried cheese and chocolate, try crisps and chocolate first. It's a good route into the cheese and chocolate. Start out of 5.
4. It's sophisticated and beautifully layered.
Sophisticated and beautifully layered for Hit Parade from Roisin Murphy. What are you saying, Alan?
Very quickly, I just want to quote a line from Fader. It says, I lay eggs every single time I think of you, which I can see becoming a very Irish expression for undying love. I lay, lay eggs every time I hear this album. It's a 5 out of 5 for me, Sean.
All right, 5 out of 5. So 4 and 5, that's quite the hit for the Hit Parade from Roisin Murphy. Let's move on to Guts from Olivia Rodrigo. 20-year-old's self-assured second album documents her hopes and fears with emotional candor. It's impossible to find a song on this that isn't potty mouthed, but there are clean versions, but not the title. The title of this song is All American B.I.T., and you can work out the other two letters all by yourself.
Stiff as a board, I pay attention to things that most people ignore, and I'm alright with the movies that make jokes about senseless cruelty, that's for sure. And I am built like a mother in a total machine. I feel for your every little issue, I know just what you need. I've got sun coming out of my pockets, best believe. Yeah, you know.
There we go, back to quiet again. It's kind of, it's an emblematic track,
it
might I say
is.
That. All yes. American B.I.T.C.H. from Olivia Rodrigo. Because you have sweet as pie acoustic guitar.
It is,
and then the bang, bang,
it
rock
the
in the middle.
It is the two sides of Olivia Rodrigo, and I think that this is what this album is. The sweet acoustic chirpy mandolin is the kind of side somewhat the industry wants to present, that she's a sweet all-American
girl.
Well,
she's been loads of Disney shows.
But it's kind of interesting. She's made the crossover from Disney kind of, tween princess to angry rocker without going through any kind of transitional period, i.e. Britney Spears, Justin Timberlake, Christina Aguilera. That song, that opener, All-American B.I.T.C.H., is very representative of the album, because it shows the two sides, the happiness and light, and then the anger and the rage.
Although it's not representative in that there isn't a single F-bomb to be heard in it. Now, we did get the radio edits, but
she really has
a potty mouth, doesn't
as well,
she?
Because you do find yourself scrambling for the volume control with her, which is kind of great in a way, because she is, as you were saying, she's 20 years old, and her music perfectly mimics, I think, the feelings that can come when you're, you know, just out of your teenage years, you're experiencing young adulthood for the first time, you're dealing with young love, you're dealing with rejection, you're dealing with feelings of crippling social anxiety. And one minute you're, I don't know, cruising down the highway feeling amazing. The next minute you're cowering in absolute mortification about something you've said.
Does that change?
I think that it, the feeling of it not being the first time, but the millionth helps, you know? But certainly, I, like for me, like there are shades here of Wet Leg, Avril Lavigne back in the day, also La Tigre a little bit. You can tell she, you know, she's got indie influences. Of course, Elvis Costello on the previous album was something of a reference point. And she's a bit like Taylor Swift's angrier, indier, cooler, younger cousin.
Okay, that's a good description. Yeah, and that's why you get the titles like Bad Idea, right? The question mark. That is such good fun, I think. Bad Idea, right, from Olivia Rodrigo and her album. The album is called, yes, Guts. She has guts, Alan.
Yeah, that's Guts, all caps, by the way. That song there, Bad Idea, right, is hilarious. I mean, she's having this internal debate about whether she should really be going out on a date with her ex. She sings, "Can't you people reconnect? I only see him as a friend. I just tripped and fell into his bed." So lyrically, I think she's very adroit. She's very clever. She can do a zinger of a pop couplet, and her songs have substance as well because she can do the weepy ballads. If you listen to something like, there's a song here that sounds like Jar of Hearts by Christina Perry, which I think is extremely good. Vampire, that's the one, the first single. She uses lines like, "How's the castle built off people you pretend to like?" So she's quite kind of bratty and sneery when it comes to her exes.
Yeah, she can manage it very well. Yeah,
and vocally, just to say, like, she has a superb vocal. Yeah. To get in the kind of mix of registers that she gets in is really very laudable. And just, you know, she can sort of morph in an instant from that soft to loud dynamic that very few singers can really manage that well.
And a little bit of a hip hoppy rapper in her as well.
I actually heard the Beastie Boys on part of this. I was like, I'm hearing the Beastie Boys.
All right. Stars from you, first time, Alan.
Very, very solid four. Anybody who thought that her debut was a fluke, this is a stinging rebuke.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a really solid four. And this album will be played and played and played. Expect to hear it a lot.
Might even play that particular Bad Idea right a few times more myself. All right, let us move on to our third and final album, Irish band Soda Blonde, their second album, which is called Dream Big. Here's the opening track called Midnight Show.
Lying low, dancing slow. Everything is changing, but I don't grow.
Tell me though, if you know.
Never mind, I have a midnight show. Red sky at night. Through the moors, I see a young man. I like how he moves. I don't speak his love.
Midnight Show, opening track on Dream Big, the new album from Soda Blonde. Alan, opening tracks kind of lay down, they make a statement of some kind, whether we're going this direction or here's something and now we're going to go a totally different direction. What does this opening track do?
Well, I think there's a huge degree of sophistication going on in this album, even more so than their debut. They really have gone all out for this album. And that opening track, Midnight Show, is, you know, a good example of what is to come. It starts with that opening string flourish. This is an album full of dramatics, very nicely arranged music. And I think, as usual with this band, the focus is always going to be on the enigmatic and elfin front woman,
Faye
O'Rourke. Extraordinary voice. And that song there we've just heard, she comes across like some Bronte heroine, like Red Sky at Night, I drift through the moors, you know, I lay in the heather, started to cry. Very dramatic stuff. She really does unburden herself on these songs. Yeah. I think it's a very fine album from a very fine band.
They do stand apart, Soda Blonde, really, from a lot of Irish indie bands, don't they?
They're dealing in a completely different type of pop music for me. I mean, I'm thinking of bands like Roxy Music or The Pretenders or a singer like Annie Lennox. You know, the Fair Rourke has a vocal for the ages. To my mind, she's one of the finest singers Ireland has produced. And I think it's a shame, actually, that she's not more recognised as that at this point in her career, because her vocal phrasing is just really
she's
quite remarkable.
Singer.
An amazing singer. You know, the songs are often also very fine. Midnight Show, that single, is a beautiful example of what they can do. For me, at times, there's a point where the album moves from, you know, there's a lovely ruefulness about a lot of the tracks. There's a sort of a world weary vibe. At times it can tread that path a little bit too much. And for a young band, because they're still a young band, they're just 4 years old, they can often sound like an older band. And that's not always as good a thing in some respects.
Yeah, I
wondered
if it was side two of the album that suddenly becomes much more introspective and low key, or in fact,
it's introspection from, you know, word go, I think. There's not many pop bangers on this. There is a very good song called Space Baby, which might be a single. I think the standout here is a song called An Accident, which is pretty epic, even for an epic sounding band like these guys. The lyrics, very cryptic, but clearly very personal. And musically, they really step up here. The guitar player, Adam, really sounds like he's releasing his inner guitar hero, I think.
And he also produces, Adam Regan.
Yeah, let's move to, I think this is towards the end of the track listing, in fact, Less Than Nothing. And it really is a very pared back sound, initially at any rate. If you wanted proof that she has a versatile voice, just compare track one, Midnight Show, that we listened to, with Less Than Nothing, the track that we just listened to there, Nadine.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's just stunning. Her, you know, it's funny because sometimes you're trying to, as a critic, you're trying to pick holes in something, and you can do that a little bit with the album, but you cannot do it with her
voice,
vocal.
Fair Rourke. Fair
really
Rourke, let's say her name again.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I was trying to see for me why at points I was like, well, you know, what would take to bring them to the next level, to the point where they're a world, you know, beating kind of name. And I think sometimes it is that those lyrics, while sometimes very beautifully observational, are very oblique. As Alan said, they're very cryptic. And, you know, I don't need her to go the full Olivia Rodrigo on it, but sometimes just to define heartbreak or define jealousy and that a little bit more for me, just to connect with the audience.
Stars on this one from Unity?
Still, it's a four. It's beautiful.
Solid four, Alan?
Oh, very solid four. It's a sign of how polished and accomplished they've become. It's a very strong album for me, four,
Good week at the headphones this week.
Really
for sure.
Good. I feel a bit bad giving four across the board, but there you go. Well, they deserve it.
Three fours ain't no bad thing. And two fours to five, is that
a five
it?
For Roisin.
Yeah, oh, sorry. Five. You gave a five.
Right, so Dream Big from Soda Blonde, Guts from Olivia Rodrigo, and Hit Parade from Roisin Murphy, our three albums this evening, Nadine O'Regan and Alan Carr. And that is our lot for this week here on Arena. Damien Chanel was on sound. Research this evening was by Paula Shields and Leah Murphy. And the programme was produced by Kay Sheehy. Finally, last but by no means least, the broadcast coordinator this evening was Michelle Gibson, as she has been on several occasions in recent years. Sadly for us, happily for another team on this particular campus, she is moving to another programme from Monday. Michelle, have a great time. Thank you. We'll miss you, miss the smile, and miss all of your great work. Best of luck on Claiborne from Monday onwards. And that is our lot. Talk to you on Monday, back here again at 7 o'clock on RTE Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.